This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Kenny Wama is the chancellor at Indiana University Northwest, and he has spent the last few months in his job here at the Gary campus, and now he's going into 2021, being at the helm of the university, and he is with us to talk about the months past and what's ahead, and thank you very much, Chancellor Wama, for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me again, Chris. I think we last spoke in July, so it's great to hear a familiar voice and talk about the last few months.
Well, the months that you have here as chancellor have been very, very busy. Of course, it's been in the midst of the pandemic that everybody has had to endure, and it's been very tough, I know, for IU Northwest and other universities in particular to deal with trying to have classes of some type because of the pandemic. Give us first an assessment of how the fall semester went with 2020 and how things look going into the spring semester now.
Well, if I could sum things up, if somebody ever asked me for advice about becoming a leader in higher education, I say, in terms of timing, mm-hmm. I'd say try not to become a chancellor during a pandemic because it has been some been a very interesting time period full of incredible challenges. Some I anticipated, but until you're here. Doing the work in the midst of the pandemic, you really don't understand the size, scope, and impact of every decision that you make moving forward. So, I think I've learned long ago that you can't pick the events that happen during your time. You know, they kind of pick you, but you have the opportunity to do what you need to do to address, especially in crisis situations, you know, how to move an institution forward. So in terms of IU Northwest, I have to say that it really has been an incredible time period in terms of, what I would call almost complete success in terms of the rollout implementation of opening up IU Northwest as a university in the fall, especially with all the concerns and all the the fear that I think everyone shared in terms of opening up during a pandemic. But, with IU support and the way we've implemented many of our safety measures here on campus is really a best practice nationally. We have, mitigation testing, which is essentially a form of, asymptomatic random testing, every week here on campus. With the help of our medical response team at IU, our localized response team here on the campus, we've been able to take a proactive approach towards the safety, health and safety of faculty, staff, and of course, our students. And so the numbers in terms of positive cases here on campus have been very minimal. And, we've avoided much of the incidences that have happened across universities across the country, which have led really to shutdown of those universities. So I couldn't be more proud. Again, it's less me, and it's really the students, faculty, and staff coming together during this extremely difficult time. Chris, I always say during times of crisis, it really can pull an organization or an institution apart, or it can bring everybody together. And in some ways, that's a conscious choice that people make. And at IU Northwest, I'm really pleased to say that I think we made the conscious decision to come together. And, I recently had, our annual gala, which was virtual this year, called the Chancellor's Medallion Ceremony. And one of the things that I did announce at that ceremony was the distribution of these special pins called, We're in This Together. These pins that people can use to memorialize and remember, 2020 as a time where we weren't torn apart, but actually brought together. So it has been a remarkable experience. So I'm a glass half full kind of guy. Mm-hmm. So, nobody wants to walk in to a leadership position during crisis and pandemic, but I have seen the best of IU Northwest, and it really solidifies my right decision in coming here.
Were there any bits of information, any examples that came back from your deans and from the department heads of how professors and other people teaching classes on campus and virtually this past semester and maybe even going into the 2021 have done and stand out as some really good examples of how to deal with things in a pandemic like this?
You know, one of the faculty members actually featured at that event in the gala. You know, we did a little video of, you know, some of the things that are happening for our students during this time of struggle, mm-hmm. and how our faculty and staff are supporting our students. But one of our, Mark Baer, who's a leader of our faculty organization, he agreed to do a performance, a dramatization of some of the emails that he has been receiving from his students during this time period about concerns about job during the economy, concerns about keeping up with their studies, concerns about sickness at the home, and all that, how it plays into the ability to students to continue their dream of higher education and attainment of degree. And I have to tell you, listening to that story about how he responded to his students' need, the support that he's giving to them, both, you know, through virtually in person when safe, and also through emails, you know, talking them through the challenges of life based upon his own experience. That really, I think, is a great symbol of what all our faculty staff have been doing for our students. The support that they have been giving is, like I said, inspirational. You know, we did a recent survey, during the aftermath of the most critical parts of the pandemic, and, you know, just a check-in survey to see how our students were doing. And the results were amazing in the sense that not only did almost 90% of our students feel safe on campus being here, you know, in the midst of everything else that's happening, these outbreaks, that they feel safe on campus because of our protocols and the efforts that we made. But they also, overwhelmingly felt positive about the academic programs that they're receiving, even though in spring we had to transition, you know, to full remote education. And in fall, although we returned to campus, it was much less number of in-person classes than we would normally have. So, again, that's a credit to the staff and faculty creating that environment for our students. And the story of Professor Baer is just one in hundreds of stories that are happening here at IU Northwest.
IU Northwest's mission includes not only education of students who come to campus in Gary, but they also involve a community engagement. And in fact, I know there is even a commission that the chancellor's office has set up for community engagement. We had a recent meeting in December dealing with issues that involve not only the campus, but the COVID-19 pandemic and virtual learning in general for schools. Will you tell us a little bit about this meeting that was held in December, some of the people that participated, and what was discussed during the session?
Yeah, so Chris, you know, one of the the things that that I was concerned about in terms of assuming a leadership position at IU Northwest during a pandemic and during times of sheltering in and really social separation from one another is you're absolutely right. Community engagement is a key part of our mission here at IU Northwest. And so, you know, I was faced with the predicament of, you know, how do you advance community engagement as a new chancellor during a time of pandemic when really people aren't gathering together. So, you know, many of the things that we're doing have gone to the virtual world. And even though you miss that kind of in-person, you know, handshaking, whether we be able to handshake and hug people again, that remains to be seen.
Right.
But, you know, that close proximity, the facial expressions, the body move, those types of things which are critical to building relationships in the community were missing. But, you know, again, on the glass half full side is that, you know, you're able to engage people, maybe even larger numbers, when you're doing it on a virtual basis. So one of those examples of advancing community engagement that you just mentioned is the Chancellor's Commission on Community Engagement. And so as we were thinking about planning this year, you know, what community engaged topic should we choose, it really came to us to really focus on, you know, the transition from high school to college and the experience that high schoolers are having, high school students are having in the age of a pandemic when, again, just like higher education, you know, the shift is going from in-person, which is traditional learning, to now remote education in many instances. And, you know, I have to say this, for higher education, I think we have a little bit of a head start because in higher education, as you know, for the past few decades, higher education has been leading online education. So, and certainly at IU Northwest, you know, we're well prepared for, maybe not necessarily prepared specifically for a pandemic, but we were well prepared for the remote world. And I think high schools may have a little bit more difficult time in terms of, you know, in terms of addressing the remote needs, but they're doing the as best they can. And this particular event that you're talking about, you know, we brought together our director for Center for Urban Regional Excellence, the principal for Crown Point High School, Russ Marcinek, Mike Beam, who is our secondary, education, school partnership assistant vice provost, senior assistant vice provost at IU. We brought our interim dean of the School of Education here at IU Northwest, and we brought Peggy Buffington, superintendent of the the city of Hobart, and really, it was a great discussion about what they're observing, their concerns on high school level, and kind of melding in with our concerns, what we're seeing on the university level. And I have to tell you, Chris, if we looked back at this time, we can probably consider this the battle of our time, maybe the battle of our generation, this pandemic. We'll be talking about it for decades, if not centuries, in the history books. But, the second battle of our time, if you ask me, is really higher education attainment. And this is kind of what we're talking about at this event. The economy is really impacting hourly wage workers at a disproportionate number, as well as first generations and students of color as well, too. So, when I say the other battle of our time, the imperative of higher education for students is never more, obvious to me and to others in education how critical that battle is. So, it was a great discussion, and it was really a learning experience for me as to what the challenges and with the great work that principals and superintendents doing are in the high schools in the Northwest region, and how we can help contribute to that moving forward.
Well, I certainly see that, and I'm sure that you and your colleagues at the other regional campuses, as well as at the main campus in Bloomington, get to talk about this often, especially when you mentioned about the efforts to try to boost the workforce development efforts that the state is putting out, of course, by the university's own efforts to be able to educate people for the jobs of the future and the like. So this is probably one of the major goals that it's continuing on, of course, from 2020 into 21, but it's probably going to be heightened if the pandemic settles down a bit.
Yeah, and absolutely. At the time of the pandemic, Indiana University also released this economic impact survey showing the impact of both all of its campuses upon the regions and the communities they serve. And one of the interesting data points that we saw as related to IU Northwest is that, IU Northwest contributes about over $260 million to its local economy. That's how important as an entity IU Northwest is to the Northwest region. But another fascinating data point was that, for students who graduate and get an actual college degree, on average, they're making about $20,000 more a year than the student that just has a high school degree. So if you extrapolate that and you think about a lifetime of learning, a lifetime of working, that amounts to almost close to $1 million difference in earnings over a work lifetime. And that's just average. So if you think, we talk about the imperative, we talk about the role of universities, and especially at a time where we have an academic downturn due to the pandemic, think about how critically imperative in terms of changing the social mobility and the economic lives of our students. I can't think of anything more important right now than really to talk about higher education to anyone who will listen. And I was talking to a fellow educator a month or so ago, and he said, we need to be evangelists for higher education, and I like that word because mm-hmm. we do really need to preach the word about how higher education is not a luxury; it is an imperative. to help students become maintain a role in our society that's economic viable, viable economically moving forward.
Well, Chancellor Romano, thank you very much for the conversation today. We hope to get back with you soon and find out more about how IU Northwest is dealing with not only the crisis in health that we're dealing with now overall, but also looking at the future for higher education. Thanks today.
Chris, anytime. I appreciate talking to you.
Kenny Wama is the IU Northwest Chancellor. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The LaPorte County Public Library has come up with an interesting way that because we don't have quite the hands-on experience in the classrooms, at least not for a while. Many of the school corporations are not allowing in-person learning, at least to start the semester, because of the coronavirus pandemic. The LaPorte County Public Library has a way to be able to take the experiences to a student. And we're talking about a mobile classroom. And to find out more about it, we have the library's community engagement manager, Susan Banwart. Susan is the lead manager on this project, and thank you for joining us on the program today.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm happy to talk with you about it.
Well, these are tough times for everybody and for education in particular, and especially as we try to get a new school year started. Tell us the idea behind the mobile classroom, how you came up with the design, or at least helped out on the design of the facility, and what students and anybody, for that matter, I suppose, that takes advantage of it will really get to learn.
This idea has been bouncing around here in our organization for a good number of years now, and we really got serious about it in 2018. We were very fortunate that we had several private donors and also an opportunity to apply for a grant. So the funding for the entire project was through donations and a grant. And what really has been a tipping point for us to decide to really go forward and move forward and implement this opportunity in our community is some data that we had seen through the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the National Assessment of Educational Progress. So when we looked at Bureau of Labor Statistics at the 30 occupations that were projected to grow the most in the next 10 years, more than 60% of those occupations are in the STEM and healthcare fields. Mm-hmm. So, and then when we looked at the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the nation's report card, that was telling us that only 30% of students in the United States were prepared for college-level science courses or for a career in STEM. And so we here have been having developing STEM-related programming for several years, and we thought, how can we get more of this information and an opportunity to schools? And so the mobile classroom was something that we said we're going to, you know, we're going for it. We've got funding and opportunities for funding here, and so we got the ball rolling, and now we finally have it here.
Describe for us what this mobile classroom looks like, and how did you and all the folks that have worked on the project come up with this design?
So this actually is a type of vehicle that's not, it's becoming more and more common. So we were fortunate that we had national and regional organizations that have a similar vehicle. So mm-hmm. we've got the Ethos Foundation over in Elkhart County, and they have a mobile classroom. And then Warsaw Public Schools also has a mobile science bus. So we were able to go and visit and tour those and talk to those people. And then further, there's an international association called the Mobile Laboratory Coalition. And that gave us an even further understanding of what's happening all over the world with mobile STEAM education. So we developed a plan for this classroom based on being able to go out and see different examples of what works in different communities. And so this vehicle is 38 foot long. Really looks like a large RV that you see on the road, you know, yeah. people vacation in. So it's on a Winnebago platform. And so it's 38 feet long, and it has, instead of the typical inside that you would see in a motorhome, it has seven workstations. So they're like desks with bench seats, and you slide into there, and then there's a large monitor on the other side of the vehicle that's a smart screen monitor, so it's touch screen, and our library instructor can present content there. And then the technology on there is we can bring out based on the lesson that we may be out in the community teaching. So that's kind of what it looks like.
Have you tried to design this mobile classroom, not only with the ways to be able to, for students to be able to see the coursework, but also to be able to experience some of the equipment, the techniques that they're liable to find if they go out there in some factory or a business in LaPorte County?
Yes, that's right. So in our county, 19% of the workforce is in manufacturing, and mm-hmm. so we really wanted to look at ways to expose students to the career opportunities available locally and regionally. And so things that we have in there relate to advanced manufacturing concepts like, some subtractive manufacturing, automation, rapid prototyping, and quality control are some of the main focuses we have on there. So we have a CNC milling machine. We have a laser cutter engraver. We have digital microscopes. We have a vinyl cutting machine. We also have Google Expeditions, which are very interesting because through Google Expeditions, you can tour things like the Subaru plant that's down by Lafayette.
Oh, yeah.
Virtually. So all these types of hands-on lessons that students can engage in while they're on the vehicle are things that we couldn't necessarily lend to schools that take training. And they're not exactly easy to just, loan out easily as some of our other things that we loan out to schools are. So by having these on the mobile classroom, we can go to a school, we can let students come aboard, experience the hands-on learning that takes place, and give them ideas that could help them understand pathways they might take in their learning. That can result in, great jobs right here in our local area and region.
We're talking with Susan Benwart. She is the Community Engagement Manager for the LaPorte County Public Library about the library's new mobile classroom that is actually out there and able to be used. Now, Susan, tell me if they have obviously had input from local businesses and industries in wanting to get this set up. Have you gotten any feedback from any of them about what they might have seen if they've toured the mobile classroom?
Well, yeah, it's been a challenge this year, of course. A lot of the community events that we had planned on attending and company-type events that were planned locally have been canceled or postponed. So it has been somewhat of a challenge to be able to get out and do some of the things that we had hoped to be able to do this year. And that's just the reality that we're in right now. So what we've been trying to do is show how the vehicle works through video and through some smaller class groups that can come through it. So we've done some online meetings and things like that to give people an idea. And overall, the feedback, people are very excited to see this get implemented this school year. We're looking forward to seeing how students are interacting and take that feedback back and adapt our plans and move on from there.
Well, sounds like if things improve and we get hands-on experience back with us again, this is going to be a great opportunity for students to be able to pick up the STEAM knowledge that they need to be able to find those high-paying jobs out there.
I believe it will, and I think it's a great way and opportunity in our community. And I do think because in our county, in our service district for the library, we're uniquely situated to be able to offer this opportunity to multiple school corporations within our county. So that helps us give access to students across our community, and we're really looking forward to being able to do that over the next many years.
Well, Susan, thank you for the great information, and it sounds like it's a great addition to not only the LaPorte County Public Library's items that can be out there to help put some education into hands for folks in LaPorte County, but just in general, it's going to be some great jobs, I'm sure, that will come from the experiences that the students that take advantage of this will have. Thank you for talking about today.
Thank you very much.
Susan,
it was a pleasure.
Susan Banwart is with the LaPorte County Public Library, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
The economic problems caused by COVID-19 have hit diabetics especially hard. The American Diabetes Association says nearly one quarter of people with the disease are using money from their savings, loans, or stimulus checks to pay for insulin. And Side Effects Public Media's Farah Yousry reports that some are taking big risks to get insulin.
It's been over 6 months since Cody Wessel lost his retail job due to the pandemic. He says he's been terrified.
Because we're surviving on the kindness of strangers and kindness from our parents right now to help us with like basic bills.
Wessel lives in St. Louis. He's 36 years old and has type 1 diabetes. He relies on daily insulin doses to stay alive. And paying for it without health insurance is much harder. But it's a bill he simply cannot skip.
Well, if I didn't have insulin, I would die in a couple of days. I mean, my monthly insulin cost is more than my rent and my phone bill and my car insurance combined.
With stalled unemployment benefits and a cashed out stimulus check, he started a GoFundMe campaign to seek donations online. He says it saved his life. And he learned that some in the diabetes community are willing to share more than just money.
Some people said, I have insulin I can send you, and they mailed me insulin to use. And, you know, that has definitely been something that has been a lifesaver.
That insulin probably came from a place similar to this one.
Being that I'm on a high deductible plan, that's my own personal stash.
Craig Miller has type 1 diabetes and lives near Indianapolis. He's showing me a medium-sized white fridge that he keeps in his garage right next to his motorcycle.
So this is the insulin that was donated to me last week. That right there, 75, about five, it's about $6,000 worth of insulin right there. If you know enough people, you know, somebody, you know, may have passed away and has insulin, ideally I would love to have everybody donate that, because I mean we can save lives with it, even though doing that is illegal.
The FDA says getting drugs this way is risky because they may be counterfeit or have harmful ingredients. The agency and other health experts say improper storage poses another big risk.
For example, insulin must be regulated at a specific temperature. It has two different expiration dates. The expiration date that we all see on food packages, you know, when the insulin goes bad, but there's another expiration date, and that's when it's become exposed to air. Some people have a reaction to maybe one brand of insulin and don't want the rest to go to waste, but it has been opened, and so considering those things.
This is Michelle Lichtman, a nurse practitioner and diabetes researcher at the Utah College of Nursing. Last year, she co-authored a study of people with diabetes, and in one sample, more than half had done some kind of underground exchange.
It's difficult to say how representative it is. However, we know that this is happening. If you look online, within social media posts and even within classified posts, people are asking for help.
Lichtman helps patients get assistance from programs that offer financial aid, but it doesn't work for everyone, and that can drive some of them to the underground market.
I've also had people say that they've met people in parking lots to exchange supplies and what they should be considering. And so we go through the safety of all of those things.
Diabetes advocates say appeals for help on social media groups and forums have nearly doubled since the pandemic. But seeking help online is tricky. Social media algorithms are trained to take down posts that have to do with prescription drug exchanges. Still, the underground market persists in places like Miller's garage.
There's 21 vials of Humalog and 3 vials of Lantus.
And do you know, like how fast can this go?
I mean, willing to mail it, I could get rid of it all right now.
Miller says as long as people have trouble paying for a life-saving drug like insulin, some will have to use underground exchanges.
It'd be like a scuba diver looking at the gauge on the thing, and he's got like 3 minutes of breath left, you know, and then somebody comes along with another tank.
For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Farah Yousry.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. On tomorrow's program, we have a conversation with State Senator Eddie Melton about the 2021 General Assembly session, an Inside Indiana Business conversation about dear old Roosevelt, and Sharon Jackson's conversation with the Admissions Director at Bishop Knoll Institute. Join us tomorrow.